Very good morning. Thank you for joining us here at the UN office at Geneva today, the 20th of January, for this press briefing hosted by the UN Information Service at Geneva. We have another very important agenda for you. We'll start off immediately with colleagues from OCHA and UNICEF to speak to the situation in Mozambique. We'll also have from the Human Rights Office subject of Sudan and Ukraine, as well as some announcements from colleagues who are in the room here. I'll also have a few announcements for you at the end of this briefing, but we'll start right away with Jens, who's going to introduce a colleague who's joining us from Mozambique. So over to you, Jens.
Yeah, thank you very much, Rolando, and good morning, everyone. As we have on the screen already, Paula, and welcome, Paula Emerson, who is the head of OCHA in Mozambique, and she is speaking to you from Shai Shai, I think it's pronounced, in southern Mozambique, which is heavily affected by rainfall that has gone on for a long time and now flooding. So with that, over to you, Paula.
Good morning, everyone, and thanks for this opportunity to speak about the impact of the floods on people here in Mozambique. More than 500,000 people have been impacted by recent floods across southern and central Mozambique, particularly in Gaza, the Gaza in Mozambique, Maputo and Sofala provinces. The numbers keep rising as extensive flooding continues and dams keep releasing water to avoid bursting. The floods have caused extensive damage to people's lives. Physical impact is also huge. 90% of the people in Mozambique live in adobe houses that basically melt after a few days' rains. Health facilities, roads, and critical infrastructure are also impacted. So far, the most affected province is Gaza, where I am today, with 64% of the affected people. Nearly 5,000 kilometers of roads have been damaged across 9 provinces, including the main road linking the capital Maputo to the rest of the country, which is currently inaccessible. As a result, supply chains are severely disrupted, and authorities also report the loss of over 27,000 heads of livestock, further undermining livelihoods. The government of Mozambique has declared a national emergency. It is leading the response and has established an emergency operations center in Gaza province, covering all affected provinces. At the same time, provincial coordination is assured by the Provincial Emergency Operations Center. The National Disaster Management Authority, INGD, and partners continue relocating people to safer areas and are conducting search and rescue operations at this point. Currently, there are 51 accommodation centers active nationwide, hosting more than 50,000 people, including around 38,000 in Gaza province. The situation remains fluid and dangerous. Search and rescue continue, but more support, more capacity is needed. Road access is severely impacted, including the risk of flash flooding linked to the rains, but also dam releases in Mozambique and upstream countries. Shai Shai town near the Limpopo River has been inundated, prompting the evacuation from this provincial capital to higher ground. Authorities have also issued alerts for downtown Shai Shai, including warnings of crocodile risks in flooded areas. On Saturday, 17 January, the government requested United Nations support for air resources for rescue operations and transport of humanitarian aid to hard-to-reach areas. Logistics, civil engineering, and disaster management specialists aimed at the temporary restoration of essential access routes and flood control and humanitarian assistance. At this stage, access and funding remain the most critical constraints. Widespread flooding and infrastructure damage have rendered large areas inaccessible, including sections of the main highway linking ports to affected areas. After flooding of the Inkomati, Umbeluzi, Limpopo, Save, and Buzi rivers in southern and central Mozambique, humanitarian partners are exploring alternative access route, including the feasibility of sea routes between Maputo and the small port of Inhamban, closer to the most affected areas. While rainfall may ease in the coming days, flood risks persist. It will take time for dam levels to reduce, flood waters to recede, and soil conditions to stabilize sufficiently to allow roads to reopen and comprehensive response and assessments to be conducted. Continued water releases are expected to remain a threat even after heavy rains subside. From just one dam, up to 10,000 cubic meters of water were being discharged. That is approximately 25 times the amount of water that could be held in the press briefing room you are in today. Every second, you cannot imagine the strength of this water and the impact it has on people and the infrastructure. Humanitarian partners are scaling up life-saving assistance with a focus on easing overcrowding in accommodation centers, particularly in Gaza province, while response and assessments continue in hard-to-reach areas. Humanitarian partners have deployed to Gaza and other areas, strengthening human emergency coordination, child protection, WASH, and displacement monitoring capacity, and IAM as well. More support is arriving, including for search and rescue, coordination, prevention of sexual exploitation and abuse, information management, and logistics support, among others. Additional funding is urgently needed to sustain and scale up the humanitarian response. This flooding emergency comes on top of massive conflict-related displacement in northern Mozambique that has depleted stocks. The number of people in need is increasing with significant protection risk. The appeal for 2026 for $352 million to support conflict-affected people remains underfunded. With the floods, more support is urgently requested. This latest disaster is a stark reminder of Mozambique's vulnerability to the convergence of multiple drought, cyclones in region, placing enormous strain on communities and capacity. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paula. We lost you for the last couple of sentences. It was a small break in the internet. Nevertheless, colleagues, we will share the notes with you. Lots of geographical names, lots of numbers. Very important update from you, Paula. Thank you very much. I'm going to stay on the subject of Mozambique. Ricardo from UNICEF is online. He's going to introduce a guest, Guy Taylor from UNICEF. But maybe we'll start with Ricardo and then over to Guy. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Orlando. Good morning, everyone. Introducing my colleague, Guy Taylor, who's also in Xai-Xai, southern Mozambique, to speak about the impact that the floods are having on children and the services that we are trying to provide to them. Over to you, Guy, and thank you for joining.
Thank you, Ricardo. Good morning, everyone. Yes, so as Paula mentioned just now, the exceptionally heavy rains that we've been seeing during the first weeks of January have really triggered a rapidly escalating emergency across vast swathes of Mozambique, particularly in the south of the country. And the flooding that we're seeing is not just destroying homes, schools, health centers, and roads. It's really turning unsafe water, disease outbreaks, and malnutrition into a deadly threat for children. And the fact that Mozambique is now entering into its annual cyclone season creates the risk of a double crisis, with the most vulnerable children impacted most severely. According to preliminary government data, as Paula mentioned, more than 500,000 people have been affected already, with that number likely to rise. And we estimate that more than half of those people are children. More than 50,000 people have been forced to flee their homes and are now sheltering across 62 temporary centers, many of those very overcrowded, creating its own risk of disease outbreaks. Access to the most basic services, so we're talking about clean water, healthcare, nutrition, education, is uncertain or unsafe at best in most impacted areas. And in that kind of condition, these kind of conditions, children really face higher risks of disease, of interrupted learning, and of course of protection risks. And that's particularly the case for girls and for adolescents. Of particular concern are waterborne, always the combination of waterborne diseases and malnutrition, which can often prove lethal. Even before the recent floods here in Mozambique, around 4 out of every 10 children were experiencing chronic malnutrition. And so this renewed disruption to food supplies, to health services, and to care practices threatens to push the most vulnerable children into a dangerous spiral. And that includes the risks, of course, of acute and severe acute malnutrition, which is the deadliest form of malnutrition. Together with government and our humanitarian partners, UNICEF is responding with urgency. In Gaza, where I am now, the most affected province, we're working very closely in support of government and with our humanitarian partners to assess the needs and to begin distributing essential supplies to the most affected children and families. At the same time, we're working to get the most critical services, so access to safe water, sanitation, hygiene, health services, education, child protection, back online as quickly as possible to avoid the disruptions and the dangers to children's life and well-being. Further north in the country, we've been providing water, sanitation, and hygiene supplies to affected districts in Sofala province, enabling the treatment of contaminated water at community and household level, and have already reached at least 13,000 households there. But it's important to emphasize that the threat to children is really growing. We have river basins above alert levels, rain continuing in some areas, and as I mentioned before, the cyclone season just getting underway. And so the number of affected children and families is really expected to rise further in the days and weeks ahead. And at the same time, critically, damaged roads and infrastructure are making access to affected communities very, very difficult. Timely support allows UNICEF and our partners to scale up safe water, nutrition, health, education, and child protection services before conditions deteriorate further. We can prevent disease, deaths, and irreversible losses to children, but we need to act fast. Mozambique is really a country of children and young people. More than half its population, around 17 million people, are under the age of 18, and the average age is just 17. And when floods and cyclones strike, as they have repeatedly and with increasing frequency over recent years, it's the youngest and children who are hit hardest, both in those first days of the emergency, but also in the months and sometimes years that follow. So for children in Mozambique, what happens in the coming days will really determine not only how many survive this emergency, but how many can recover, how many can return to school and rebuild their futures. Thank you very much.
Thanks to you, Guy, very much, and again to Paola. So we'll turn now to you, colleagues, for questions. We'll start with any in the room here in Geneva. Yes, Emma of Reuters.
Good morning. Amidst all the threats that come with these rising water levels, are crocodiles a concern? I understand there's a lot in the country, in the river systems. Is there a risk of them moving out of the rivers into populated areas and maybe attacking people? Just a question. Thank you.
Maybe I think Paola might be, Guy chime in as well, but we'll start with Paola.
From what I understand, what is happening is the river levels are rising and are reaching urban areas or heavily populated areas. So the crocodiles that are in these in the Limpopo River in this case are able to get into areas, urban or populated areas that are now submerged underwater. That is the concern that has been expressed in downtown Shishai, which is the provincial capital of Gaza and a key entrepôt linking the north and the south of the country.
Thanks very much. Guy, if there's anything you want to add at any point in time, maybe just raise your hand or...
No, nothing to add, thanks.
Okay, thanks very much. Okay, further questions in the room? No, let's check online. Okay, I don't see that's the case. Well, your briefings were very comprehensive, and I think, Ricardo, if you can share Guy's notes, that would be much appreciated. And as mentioned, we will share Paola's notes as well. So thank you both very much for joining us from Mozambique, and do keep us updated on the developments there. And thank you for your excellent work you're doing there, and best of luck. So thanks again. I think we will then move on to Ravina of the Human Rights Office, who will shortly join me on the podium, who will address firstly, Sudan, about the situation in Kordofan, and then we also have a subject on Ukraine. So we'll get settled in. Thank you very much. Whenever you're ready, thanks.
Thank you, Rolando, and good morning, everyone. As you know, the High Commissioner was just in Sudan for a five-day visit. I was with him. We went to Port Sudan and then to Northern State, to a few places, Dongola, where we met with a lot of more than 50 NGOs and international NGOs and humanitarian volunteers who are doing really inspirational work in Sudan. We then visited an IDP camp and also a dam and a power station that had been hit by drones. The High Commissioner asked me to come here today to emphasize his warning on Kordofan. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, on Sunday ended a five-day visit to Sudan with a stark warning to the parties to the conflict. The horrific violations and abuses committed during the capture of El Fasher in North Darfur must under no circumstances be repeated in Kadugli and Dilinj in South Kordofan. During his visit to Sudan, and in particular to the Al-Afad site for internally displaced people in Adaba in Northern State, which is sheltering some 20,000 displaced people, we bore witness to the trauma and the reverberating impact of the brutality that children, men, and women have suffered in El Fasher as they attempted to flee. The capture of El Fasher in late October was characterized by widespread summary executions, the use of sexual violence as a weapon of war, dehumanizing treatment, and abductions for ransom. The offensive was preceded by a suffocating 18-month-long siege that prevented civilians from getting food, access to health, and other basic needs, with constant attacks on residential areas and civilian infrastructure. The High Commissioner urged all parties to the conflict, including in a meeting with an RSF delegation on Sunday, to ensure that the crimes committed during and after the takeover of El Fasher are not repeated in Kadugli, Dilinj, and the wider Kordofan region. Reports suggest that additional troops from the Rapid Support Forces and allied SPLM North are about 20 kilometers now from the besieged city of Kadugli, which is currently under the control of the Sudanese Armed Forces and where famine conditions have been confirmed. We've heard reports of relentless military engagement, heavy shelling, drone bombardments, and airstrikes by parties to the conflict, causing widespread destruction and collapse of essential services. Over 25,000 people have already been displaced from their homes across South Kordofan since late October, when the hostilities intensified in that region. The High Commissioner identified a number of immediate measures that the parties can implement at once. Safe passage must be ensured for civilians who leave areas of active conflict. They must be protected from summary executions, sexual violence, reprisal attacks based on alleged collaboration, arbitrary detention, and abductions. All parties to the conflict need to ensure that forces allied with them or under their control act in accordance with international human rights and humanitarian law, including, crucially, by repressing such violations and holding those responsible for violations and abuses to account regardless of their affiliation. Throughout the course of this conflict, all parties have perpetrated gross violations and abuses of international human rights law and serious violations of IHL, notably when the fighting intensifies to bring new areas under the control of one of the parties. In a report to the Security Council yesterday, the International Criminal Court assessed the commission of both war crimes and crimes against humanity around the fall of El Fasher and beyond. This validates very much our own findings. Having witnessed the destruction of critical civilian infrastructure at the Merowe Dam and hydroelectric power station, the High Commissioner said the RSF and the SAF must cease intolerable attacks against civilian objects that are indispensable to the population, including markets, health facilities, schools, and shelters. They must ensure the protection of civilians and unimpeded access for the delivery of humanitarian aid. Protection from arbitrary detention is essential, and all those deprived of liberty must be treated humanely in accordance with international law. As the High Commissioner has said, a chronicle of cruelty is unfolding before our very eyes, and we must not look away. All those who have influence, including regional actors, and notably those who supply arms and benefit economically from this war, need to act urgently to put an end to it.
Thank you very much, Ravina. I'll turn to you for questions. Nina, AFP.
Thank you, Ravina. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about the meeting with the RSF on Sunday. Sort of what was, how did that go, and who did he meet with, and what was the outcome? Thank you.
Thanks, Nina. Yes, indeed, the meeting took place actually in Nairobi on Sunday at the request of the RSF. He met with the delegation, and just to be clear, he met with them as a party to the conflict. He was clear that the meeting in no way implied recognition of their self-declared administration in areas controlled by them. The High Commissioner, of course, needs to engage with all parties to the conflict in order to convey his concerns and our reports regarding the conduct of hostilities and to press for action to address the violations and uphold the protection of civilians. When he spoke to them, he emphasized in particular exactly what I have said today. He drew their attention to the fact that he met personally with victims of the violations committed in El Fasher. He looked women in the eye, women who have been subject to brutal gang rape and other violence, seen their families killed in front of them, been looted of all their belongings, not only money, gold, but also identification documents and even educational degrees were looted from them, leaving them with very little to be able to carry forward in their future. He raised all these concerns directly with the RSF delegation, and he emphasized to them that their leadership is responsible for preventing these violations and that they are accountable for the violations that are committed. There was some discussion about whether these were individual isolated cases, and the High Commissioner emphasized that according to our monitoring, these are not isolated cases. There is a systemic use of sexual violence, and we have identified patterns of violations, including summary executions, arbitrary detentions, torture, abduction for ransom. He emphasized to them directly, and he asked them to take this higher up, that these violations should not be replicated when the fight for Kadugli and Dilinge is underway, and that we are watching.
And did you receive any, or did he receive any assurances from them about how they would act going forward?
I won't speak for them. They have actually issued a statement, as you're aware. Unfortunately, in their statement, they did ascribe some words to the High Commissioner. They said that the High Commissioner welcomed efforts towards accountability. He did not. He did not welcome efforts towards accountability. He insisted on the need for accountability for the violations committed in order for them to be prevented. But on their response, I would refer you to them.
Thank you again. Further questions for Ravina on Sudan? Okay, I don't see. Oh, yes, go ahead. Sorry, Nina. Yeah, of course.
Sorry, just on another subject. I was wondering if you have any reaction to the bulldozing of UNRWA's headquarters in East Jerusalem, which is happening today. Among other issues?
Sure. I mean, we do have other agenda items. We have Ukraine and we have announcements. But why not, since you posed the question, I mean, what I can do is share with you, and I'll read elements of a post that Philippe Lazzarini just put out. As you might have heard, early this morning, the Israeli forces stormed the UNRWA headquarters, a United Nations site in East Jerusalem. Now, this is a new level of open and deliberate defiance of international law, including of the privileges and immunities of the United Nations by the State of Israel. Again, I'm paraphrasing from Mr. Lazzarini's statement, which he put out a short while ago. This demolition constitutes an unprecedented attack against a United Nations agency and its premises, and it comes in the wake of other steps taken by Israeli authorities to erase the Palestine refugee identity. You might recall that on January 12th, Israeli forces stormed into an UNRWA health center in East Jerusalem and ordered it to close. Now, together, these actions with previous arson attacks and a large-scale disinformation campaign fly in the face of the ruling in October by International Court of Justice, which restated that Israel is obliged under international law to facilitate UNRWA's operations, not hinder or prevent them. And the court also stressed that Israel has no jurisdiction over East Jerusalem. These are elements from the post of Mr. Lazzarini, the Commissioner General of UNRWA, which we received a short while ago. We will be following these developments as they just occurred a short while ago, and we'll certainly keep you updated. I'm not sure if you had anything to add, Ravina, on that.
I would like to add our outrage, the High Commissioner's outrage at this incident, and it compounds what we've been seeing for a while, attacking aid groups and UN actors who are trying to help.
Indeed. Thank you very much. And of course, we'll keep you abreast of the developments, as just mentioned. So let's move to Ukraine. If you would be so kind to just announce you have something on Ukraine, and then we have another subject. I think maybe Pascal will join us afterwards after the announcement. But let's go to Ukraine first. Go ahead.
Thanks, Rolando. Just one note on Sudan. If any of you is interested in hearing more about the visit, I'd be very happy to sit with you and share. It's rare for us to actually sit with people who are directly experiencing these violations and be able to convey that. And not only that, but also the visit to the dam and the hydroelectric power station, where we saw the remnants of drones and we saw exactly the impact that this conflict is having. And also to bring some nuance to the situation, those of you who have visited areas, you know, war zones, basically, you will understand that there's a lot of nuance there. And as I've been saying, sometimes, you know, people sitting in far-flung places in the world, in small towns in the U.S. or in Europe, when you think of Sudan, you think of this dark place that's beset by conflict and everyone's a victim and destitute and desperate. That's not the case. That's not the case. We met people whose spirit is undeterred, who are thinking, right, what can I do to help? And who are taking things into their own hands to the extent possible. And where they don't have the power to actually end this conflict, they're doing what they can to help people not suffer so much, to do what they can to build communities and to take control where they can. And we saw a lot of that. So I'd be very happy to sit with you and share. We also have a lot of footage from there, which we're happy to share. Journalists are restricted big time. Just in our trajectory, we encountered so many checkpoints, really difficult for journalists to do their jobs. So we're very happy to share footage, photos, testimony, whatever you need. Just please reach out. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Ukraine. Yep. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, said he was outraged by the repeated large-scale attacks by the Russian Federation on energy infrastructure in Ukraine following more strikes last night, which shut down heating and electricity in major urban areas, including in Kyiv and Odessa, among others. This, as the people of Ukraine are gripped by extreme cold, with temperatures below minus 10 degrees Celsius at night. Civilians are bearing the brunt of these attacks, and they can only be described as cruel. They must stop. Targeting civilians and civilian infrastructure is a clear breach of the rules of warfare. Last night's attacks with long-range weapons caused emergency power and heating outages in several regions. In Kyiv City, the mayor has reported that 5,635 multi-story residential buildings were left without heating this morning, nearly 80% of which had only recently had heating restored after outages caused by similar attack on the 9th of January. This means that hundreds of thousands of families are now without heating, and several areas, including a significant part of Kyiv, are also without water. This affects in particular the most vulnerable, including children, older people, and those with disabilities. The Russian Federation has persisted in launching these large-scale strikes despite extensive and well-documented public information regarding their severe impact on the civilian population. Since October last year, Russian armed forces have renewed systematic large-scale attacks against Ukraine's energy infrastructure, with strikes recorded in at least 20 regions of the country. Following on similar strikes in 2024, these attacks have degraded Ukraine's energy system as a whole, which has resulted in rolling power outages across most regions of Ukraine, routinely lasting up to 18 hours per day over recent months. The High Commissioner calls on Russian authorities to immediately cease these attacks. It is appalling to see civilians suffering in this way.
Absolutely. Thank you so much again, Ravina, for this update. So let's turn to you. Should you have questions on Ukraine for Ravina? Yes, Beza Anadolu.
Thank you, Rolando. Actually, I have a question on another matter, and
it's directed to you,
but maybe Ravina would like to chime in as well.
Okay, I just want to make sure there are no questions on Ukraine before we move on to another subject. I think that may be the case, so I think you were very comprehensive, and thank you. And I see that you already shared the notes, so thank you very much for that, on Sudan and Ukraine. Okay, Beza, back to you then.
Thank you again, Rolando. Actually, this is directly to you, and if Ravina would chime in, I would love that. Yesterday, Syria's interior ministry said that SDF released 120 ISIS detainees in a prison with thousands still at large. How does UN assess the risk of ISIS regrouping following this release amid ongoing clashes in northern Syria? And how does UN assess the security implication of these releases? Thank you.
If you give me a moment, I think this was addressed at our briefing yesterday as well. And of course, the situation is worrying, in particular, the damage to critical infrastructure, the situation in Syria is, you know, where hundreds of families remain unable to leave certain areas, is really worrying. New displaced families are facing terrible conditions as well. So the UN and its partners are continuing to respond where we have access and provide trauma care. OCHA also issued a note, I believe, which speaks to some of the things that we're doing and why we're doing it. I mean, we've been focusing on the situation in Syria. There was a respite at some point, but things are actually rather worrying, and this is a situation that we are obviously very, very closely following. I don't have much more to add other than to say that I will definitely seek more guidance and maybe get back to you on specifics from what we can share with our colleagues on the ground. I don't know if there's anything that Ravina or other colleagues want to add on this particular situation. I don't know.
No, Rolando, I don't have anything specific on ISIS, but I can check with colleagues if they have information, Beza, and come back to you. What I do have is that we are concerned about reports of renewed fighting between the Syrian army and the SDF, despite the 18th of January ceasefire agreement. We again would like to emphasize something we've been saying for a long time, that any integration of security forces, of SDF forces in particular, into state institutions must take place within a proper human rights-based vetting process to ensure that any individuals involved in human rights violations or abuses are not integrated, and to also urge accountability in line with human rights standards. But I'll come back to you if we have something specific on ISIS. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much, Ravina. Thanks again, Beza. Nina, yep.
Sorry, this is a different subject again. I was wondering if there are any comments on the situation in Iran. I know there's been a request now for a special session at the Human Rights Council. Do you think that's important? And also, do you have any idea on when that might be held, Rolando? Thank you.
I think the man in the back row there might be better placed to answer that question. So, Pascal, if I could ask you to come up. In the meantime, just maybe I can remind you of what I shared with you on Friday, which still stands. You know, the situation is one of concern in Iran. Our Assistant Secretary General, Martha Pobee, did brief this emergency session of the Security Council on Friday. I spoke to that. Actually, it was Thursday evening, pardon me, and I spoke to that on Friday. Of course, she framed the situation as fluid and deeply concerning, and that remains the case. Secretary General, obviously, these are the words of the Secretary General voiced through his Assistant Secretary General. But maybe I'll turn on the specific question of the special session over to Pascal.
Thank you, Rolando. Good morning, everyone. The United Nations Human Rights Council is expected to hold a special session to address the deteriorating human rights situation in the Islamic Republic of Iran, end quote, on Friday, the 23rd of January, 2026. The special session is set to take place in the Assembly Hall at the Palais des Nations in Geneva, starting at 2 p.m. GMT plus one, and to last until 6 p.m. This special session was requested on Monday evening by Iceland, together with Germany, North Macedonia, the Republic of Moldova, and the United Kingdom. For a special session to be convened, the support of one-third of the 47 members of the Council is required. And so far, this request for a special session is supported by 21 states members of the Council. This request is also supported by 30 observer states at the Council. And the list of signatories remains open until the start of the special session. So if held this coming Friday, this will be the 39th special session of the Human Rights Council since it was founded 20 years ago. And just as a reminder, on 24 November 2022, the Council already held a special session on Iran. And this special session will be webcast live in the sixth official language of the UN. Thank you.
Thanks very much for that confirmation. And of course, big meeting this coming Friday, the 23rd, which I'm sure you'll all be following. Further questions, other subjects are welcomed. Before we go to our announcements, any for Ravina, Pascal, for me? No? Okay. Nor online. Thank you again, Pascal. Ravina, as always, thank you so much. Thomas, may I ask you to come up? And Catherine. Somebody left their phone. Oh. Well, you can get it after. So Thomas has an announcement on an upcoming UNECE meeting concerning water, and then Catherine will have something on the UN Trade and Development publication. So Thomas, over to you.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. With less than a year to go before the UN Water Conference in December 2026, which will be co-hosted by the UAE and Senegal, leaders will gather in Dakar next week on the 26th and 27th for a high-level preparatory meeting for this conference with the aim of strengthening global ambition on water and sanitation, specifically to address Sustainable Development Goal 6. Now, this is not a UNECE meeting. UNECE will be present. It's a UN-wide process following on from the 2023 UN Water Conference and building on the momentum that was garnered there. So to put this in perspective a little bit, the challenges that are faced. So according to the latest UN SDG report, 2025, despite progress between 2015 and 2024, 2.2 billion people still lack safely managed drinking water. And 3.4 billion live without safely managed sanitation. Only just over half of domestic wastewater is safely treated worldwide. Now, many countries in Northern Africa, Western Asia, and Central and Southern Asia are facing critical water stress exceeding 75%, and about 10% of the global population now live under high or critical water stress. So the meeting will assess progress and gaps and try to accelerate that progress where possible. Now, in particular, I want to draw your attention to one of the six main conference themes, which is water cooperation, so cooperation on shared water resources. And UNECE will be showcasing this cooperation with partners, with governments and partners, specifically the progress under the UN Water Convention, which, as you know, is a UN treaty serviced by UNECE that provides a legal framework and intergovernmental platform for water cooperation. Now, based on 30 years of success in the pan-European region, the convention, as you know, became open for accession to all UN member states globally. This was in 2016. And in less than 10 years, 16 countries worldwide have joined this treaty. That includes 13 in Africa, where 90% of water is in shared basins, as well as Iraq, Panama, and Bangladesh in recent years. Now, there are 57 parties worldwide, and about 30 countries currently considering joining. So if all those countries joined, the membership of the convention would reach over half of the 153 UN member states that share water with their neighbors. Why are countries doing this? Why is this cooperation mounting? Why is the momentum growing? It's because it strengthens the foundations for peace, for security, for sustainable development, for climate adaptation. water crosses borders, and so do the risks associated with it. So this is really a success story of multilateralism, which countries are increasingly seizing. So that's the emphasis we want to put for this conference. Just a quick mention that back-to-back with the official preparatory meeting in Dakar next week, there will be negotiations, high-level negotiations, on the Senegal-Mauritania aquifer basin. Now, around 20 million people depend on this basin in the Gambia, Guinea-Bissau, Mauritania, and Senegal. UNECE has been supporting those negotiations for over 5 years now, and they're expected to result in the finalization of a draft to be submitted at the conference in December. UNECE will be present in Dakar, and we invite you to connect us with your colleagues who will be covering in the region. That would be much appreciated. I'll share with you the notes shortly. You have all the information there. Thank you.
Thanks in advance, Thomas. That's a supremely important subject, and thank you for clarifying not a UNECE meeting, but one system-wide and incredibly important gathering. So thank you very much. Any questions, sir, Thomas? No, I think not. And thanks in advance for sharing those notes with us, Thomas. On that note, I turn to my right, Catherine of UN Trade and Development. Over to you.
Thank you, Rolando. Good morning, everyone. Je vais parler en français and my notes will be in English. La CNUSED va publier son update, sa mise à jour des tendances de l'investissement étranger direct, j'espère cet après-midi, mais au plus tard demain matin. Et les affaires reprennent. Les investissements étrangers directs globaux ont augmenté de 14% en 2025. Mais les investissements réels, eux, n'ont progressé que de 5%. La différence s'explique par les flux qui transitent par les centres financiers mondiaux. On les déduit des 14% pour arriver à 5% d'augmentation des investissements réels. Il reste donc fragile et le fossé entre pays développés et pays en développement se creuse. Comme on peut s'y attendre, les économies développées prennent de l'avance, tandis que les pays en développement, eux, restent à l'arrière. Le moral des investisseurs, selon un certain nombre d'indicateurs, est à la baisse. La valeur des fusions et acquisitions a chuté de 10%. Le financement de projets internationaux a diminué pour la quatrième année consécutive. On est à moins 16% en valeur et pour retrouver un niveau qui était celui de 2019. Et le nombre d'annonces de projets Greenfield, il s'agit d'installations nouvelles, a chuté donc de 16%. Cette analyse montre que ce sont les centres de données qui sous-tendent les nouvelles tendances de l'investissement. Les data centers mènent la danse de l'investissement mondial. Ils représentent plus d'un cinquième des nouveaux projets d'investissement en 2025. Et là, je parle toujours en valeur. D'autre part, les investissements dans les infrastructures et les énergies renouvelables continuent de s'affaiblir. On lit ça par le biais du désintérêt vers les énergies renouvelables et les risques évalués par les investisseurs sur le retour sur leurs investissements et les problèmes de régulation qui risquent de changer. Les projets d'infrastructure ont donc chuté de 10% en grande partie. En lien donc avec ces problèmes sur les énergies renouvelables, ces hésitations sur les énergies renouvelables et les risques et incertitudes géopolitiques. Voilà, donc ce document qui est court sera distribué sans embargo dans l'après-midi ou demain matin et les experts qui ont contribué à cette analyse seront disponibles pour les commenter selon vos désirs. Voilà, merci.
Merci à toi, Catherine. C'est très clair. Des questions pour Catherine? Non? OK. Oh, we have a question from John Zarakostas. France 24 in The Lancet.
Yes, good morning. Can you hear me there?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes. Yes, my question is related to the Secretary General, Ms. Greenspan, if she has... She had mentioned in a press conference when she would be formally running for Secretary General, she'd be stepping aside. Has she formally started running for Secretary General, or is the paperwork still in the pipeline? Thank you.
I think the paperwork is still in the pipeline.
There you have it. Okay, thank you very much for the questions. Oh, yes, Emma, go ahead. You beat me to the punch, Emma. I was just about to say something about that. I think for our colleagues, I think no questions for Thomas or Catherine. So maybe just to wrap up, just a note to remind you, in fact, draw your attention, draw your attention what was said yesterday. Last night, our time, our spokesperson in New York did, in fact, announced that the Secretary General has unfortunately had to cancel his participation at the World Economic Forum's annual meeting in Davos. It was scheduled for tomorrow, but he's got a bad cold. And he's actually in Switzerland. He's probably en route back to New York now. So we had announced that yesterday. So his participation in Davos is unfortunately canceled. As you know, he was in Switzerland for a short while, where he was meeting nearby with his special and personal representatives and envoys. But that meeting is now concluding, and he's en route back to New York, as mentioned. So.
And is there any comment at all on his behalf on this Board of Peace Charter and kind of where it leaves the UN's initiative on peace, broken peace in the world? Is this a threat to the UN?
Listen, I mean, you know, the Board of Peace, as you know, it's as a result of this intergovernmental body was proposed by President Trump to implement part of its 20-point Gaza peace plan, but this is not a UN plan. It was endorsed, or rather authorized, by the Security Council strictly for its work in Gaza, right? Now, our engagement, that is, the UN's engagement, is limited to its work on Gaza. We have, as I mentioned, the statement which we issued Thursday last week, through which we welcomed the ceasefire and all measures to support that. And we will continue to work with all parties on the ground to help ensure it's upheld. But the Board of Peace, again, it's not part of the UN plan. The UN did not draft the plan. Again, the UN supports humanitarian stability efforts in Gaza, but that's as far as I could go on that. Any questions, any further questions, I should say, on that subject? No? Okay, let me just announce a couple of other things before we wrap up, just simply to keep you on track for the meetings taking place here. You heard from Pascal about the upcoming meeting this Saturday, the 23rd, a special session of the Human Rights Council on Iran. I should also mention that we have the Human Rights Council's Universal Periodic Review, which we announced last week. It started off yesterday, in fact. This afternoon, the Council's subsidiary body is reviewing Nauru, South Pacific Island, and this morning it's Mauritania, in fact. Tomorrow it's Rwanda and Nepal, and the rest of the 11 countries to be reviewed are in this nice timetable, which you, I'm sure, have printed out. The Committee on the Rights of the Child was expected to review the report of Ethiopia today, but that has been postponed to Monday. So the CRC, the Committee on the Rights of the Child, will review Ethiopia on Monday. The Conference on Disarmament this morning, it opened its session on yesterday, in fact, and this morning it's its first public plenary of its 2026 session, and under the presidency of Mongolia. Last but not least, as I announced this coming Thursday, the 22nd of January at 10 a.m. in this room, we'll have a press conference with the new composition of the new members of the Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, including East Jerusalem and Israel. Again, the names of the commissioners, well, you know, Chris Sidoti is a returning commissioner who you know well. The new members and the new chairperson is Srinivasan Muralidhar. And then there is another member, Florence Mumba. So the three members of the commission will be here at 10 a.m. on Thursday to speak with you. That's all I have. So if you don't have further questions for me, I wish you a good afternoon and see you here on Friday. Thanks.